From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. In tribute to Captain Jerry Roberts, here's the interview he gave the Bletchley Park podcast in February 2013, after hearing he'd been awarded the MBE in recognition of his tireless campaign to raise awareness of his colleagues' achievements. Sir John Scarlett, chairman of the Bletchley Park Trust, has described Captain Roberts as a true gentleman who was unfailingly modest about his own achievements.
This is ITV, you understand?
Yes. I have endless questions I'd like to ask you, so we'll just pick a few. So let's go back to 2003 when information about Tunny started to become declassified. What made you sort of prick your ears up and realise things were changing and you'd start to be able to tell the story?
Well, I was quite astonished because for all that length of time, I hadn't thought about Bletchley Park at all. Hadn't crossed my mind. It was just something that happened in the dim and distant past, almost to somebody else, you know.
Must have taken on a sense of unreality those war years, almost, within the context of the rest of your career, because it was so
unusual. It was very
unusual.
Yeah. It was very special. The fact that you couldn't tell anybody about it, and the fact that from what you'd seen you realised it was so confidential and so important, it was strange not to be able to talk about it. And of course I didn't. In that year, 2003, my wife May knew that I'd worked at Bletchley Park, but I hadn't told her what I'd worked on. In other words, on Tunny, that was still classified, but I didn't tell her. And we were very close, tell each other everything, nearly everything.
So you must have then started to tell her what you'd done. She must have been fascinated to start to hear.
Oh, yes.
Details. She's one of the most passionate advocates with you of this story to make sure people know.
She is completely, indeed. All the emails, all the letters, fixing all the appointments, arranging the transport and travel. It's endless, a lot of work, and she's done it so well.
Now, 2003, there's a gap, really, before you began your campaign in earnest. So what led you in, what, about 2008 to really get going? 2007.
Professor Jack Copeland, who wrote the book, which was published in 2006, and he invited me to write a chapter for it, which I did. And then in 2007, on a very dark November night, he and I gave a joint talk at Bletchley Park. He had 40 minutes and I had 40 minutes. And that was the start of it all, you know.
And you haven't stopped since?
No.
You're not ready to until?
Absolutely not.
Until you feel the story's
better told.
There's always been plenty to do.
There's been a great deal of interest in recent years and now recognition of how hard you've worked to generate and sustain that interest in the MBE.
Well, yes. The actual citation of my award refers to the promotion that I've done at Bletchley Park rather than the work I did during the war.
Does that seem odd, given
strange.
The importance of what you did during the war?
That's exactly a good way of putting it. You know, it was important work. The Russians could have lost at Kursk. We could have lost on D-Day. All the decrypts that we had helped against those things.
In their millions, people still don't know the details of this. There were key points in the war at which Tunny decrypts made a huge difference to the way things turned out. And this was down to 9 people in the testery. Not only those, of course, but it boils down to the expertise of a very few people, doesn't it?
It was. We were the kind of superstars. The people who did the majority of the breaking messages were us three who were in at the beginning, what are they called, the senior codebreakers? That's Peter Erickson, Dennis Oswald, and myself. We did the great majority of the breaking. We were all three linguists, good linguists. Peter Erickson spoke German at home. Dennis taught German at Uppingham, the public school, and I had just finished my degree in German. And my mother, who was so far-seeing, had taken me abroad to Germany after my schooling ended, and I spent 6 weeks there in a boarding house talking with other people, getting the conversational German going, and that gives you so much more confidence. The German middle class spoke classical German in the way that you and I speak good English. They spoke good German, and they were all semi-professional people. Herr Kaufmann had been an accountant in a big company, and they were all good, solid middle class.
Those 6 weeks changed the course of your life then, really?
They helped.
So you were decrypting and reading messages that were sent by the absolute top brass, Hitler himself, and the very few at the highest level.
It was high level. The messages most often were signed at one end by one of four people, four field marshal, Keitel, who was the head of the whole army, von Jodl, who was the chief of staff of the army, the top operating officer, and his number two, Varlamont. And then, of course, the fourth was Hitler himself. That started in early 1944. And I remember today the excitement when we broke the first message with his signature on. And indeed, when I broke my first message signed by him, it really was special. I worked out the total number of messages we deciphered. 64,000. We were breaking Tunny on an almost industrial scale. Five links, the three Russian links, the West, and Italy. They all use different sets of wheel patterns. So that's five sets of wheel patterns we had to break every day. From the 1st of Jan 1944, an edict had gone out which said you must change the patterns every day. And those patterns we in the test tree had to break every day. For the wheel patterns, you need only up to 50 consecutive places. And one thing to find out the wheel patterns, but you've got to know where to start on those wheels. For the messages, the individual messages, to fix the start points, you'd need maybe 12 to 15 consecutive places. The wheels were all prime numbers long or almost all. So you'd have one which is 37 long, and you'd have to fix at what point on that 37 your message began, because you would decipher right from the beginning of the message. So that meant if you broke the message 100 places in, you had to work your way back to the beginning, establish where to start, and then you could decipher that message.
How long did it generally take to get into the day's setting?
It varied. Typically, you would expect to break it within a shift, which was 8 hours. Sometimes it would be tough and difficult. In that case, very often people stayed on until they'd broken it because they couldn't give up. Other times they'd feel, well, I haven't got far enough, and they'd leave it to someone on the next shift.
A fresh pair of eyes.
Yeah.
It must have been an incredible level of application and concentration that most of us mere mortals just can't comprehend.
It was, but it didn't feel like that. Peter Hilton summarised it well when he said, it's the most exciting thing I've ever done in my life. And you've got to break in and start it.
I struggle to imagine what it must have been like come the end of the war, having done something you knew at the time how important it was,
And you just had to lock it away and start again, doing something completely different and not mention it.
Well, I was helped by the fact that the next job I did, because the army switched me to something totally different, difficult to imagine anything less similar, because I'd literally just sat on your bottom with paper and pencil. With war crimes investigation, you were driving around everywhere in a car to find the informants. I didn't find it as interesting as cryptography, but I learned how to drive, which was a bonus, which is an amusing story. I didn't know how to drive at all, and I was plonked in this unit where every officer had a chauffeur and a car. But the chauffeur didn't do all the driving, you did 50% and shared it with him. So I had to learn. So I was taken out in a jeep by Major Thornton. How the man must have suffered. We spent the whole first day not getting into second gear because the jeep had a pretty fierce clutch. And we went out a second day, and luckily the penny dropped, and I was able to carry on. But after that, I was driving hundreds of miles in no time at all.
So straight from breaking messages from Hitler and the High Command and deducing the settings and breaking into these fiendishly complex messages for 4 years to try to find second gear in the German countryside. It almost must have wiped away and been a really fresh start.
Well, that's it. That's what I say. You didn't miss Bletchley Park, but you were too busy thinking about what you were doing because you had to do the driving. But then when you got there, you had to interview, usually a witness, sometimes the suspected villain, and you'd have to remember all the circumstances of the case that had been described to you. And ask her questions like a lawyer. I didn't have any training at all in that. But you got used to it. And nobody ever complained about my returns. So I must have been doing something right.
So while you're at Bletchley, you were privy to information that most weren't, reading decrypts of messages sent at the highest level of command. Did you, do you think, have a different kind of level of awareness of some of the harsh realities of what was happening in the war than people who relied on propaganda-led news, if you like, to get their impression of what was happening?
I don't think, to be quite honest, we thought in those terms. We had a job of work to do, and we got on with it, broke it, and then got on with the next one.
So what you're saying is you were fully concentrating on the task in hand. And not thinking about periphery.
That's right. Plenty to deal with.
I understand. Later, after the war, did the scale of what people had done to other people come as a shock?
You were brought into contact with the grimier side, the more criminal side of life.
Probably mostly on an individual level, was it, rather than huge atrocities?
Oh, very much so. But bear in mind, we were dealing with witnesses. Rather than the later accused, or the complainant, as it were. There were still some very dicey interviews, though.
Must have been harrowing work.
Again, you took it in your stride.
A side of humanity you'd rather not examine too closely, I imagine.
Yeah.
So, moving on, you then went on to have a very successful career in market research.
And marketing. And that was different because after 3 or 4 years, I was invited to go out to Venezuela and set up the first market research company, first general one, in South America. Certainly the first in Venezuela. And as far as I could ascertain, there weren't any others, not even in Argentina. So I classed it as the first in South America. Of course, I didn't know Spanish. I had to mug that up very quickly.
Sure, that was no great difficulty for you.
Very easy when we got French. I had my first client meeting about a month after I got out there.
So when you really got going in 2007 and started giving talks and campaigning, Did you set out with a clear vision at that point? And has it grown in recent years? The passion you have is incredible for spreading the word about this important aspect of...
And it'd be nice to say yes. The reality is that it grew like topsy. The UCL opportunity came along, and then one of my business contacts heard about it and invited me to talk to about 80 people from his clients and from his staff. Then there was another, the big UCL one, with 500 people. You never expected there to be another one after that, but there always was. And on Thursday next, I'll be doing number 18.
You do have very much a fire in your belly to make sure that people understand the importance of the work carried out. The effort you've gone to spread the word has got its own momentum. I think demand will keep growing. And the four T's you talk of. Turing, much better recognised than when you set out. Tut, not yet, but getting there.
Well, Turing...
Tommy Flowers a little bit more. And the Turing, test three, not
yes.
enough.
But Tut and Tommy Flowers, hardly anything. The only person who's been promoting Bill Tut is myself, because I believe he deserves it. His achievement was astonishing. General Eisenhower, after the war, said Bletchley Decrypt shortened the war by at least 2 years. Do you know how many people died each year? 10 million. And what I don't understand is that any other country would be proud of these people and would cry their achievements from the rooftops. Here, for whatever reason, it is a phenomenon and I don't understand it. People will praise Montgomery for winning this battle and winning that battle. They will give him titles and medals. Cryptographers who did things sometimes more important than Montgomery did get nothing. Let's give a comparison. Wellington, who served the country well after Waterloo, was created Duke of Wellington and given one Piccadilly Place, big house in London. A century before, John Churchill did the same. He fought various battles. The last one was Blenheim. He was given Blenheim Palace, 64 acres. Do you know what reward Alan Turing got? A bonus of £200 and an OBE. Unbelievable. Do you know what Tommy Flowers got? He got an innovation award of £1,000. I know it's worth more than them, not that much. And he'd already been made an MBE. He had to sit and suffer while people like Bill Gates made fortunes. And Tut? Absolutely nothing. To this day, nothing. It's a national scandal.
You worked with Bill Tut in the testery. How do you remember him?
We were like two Red Indians from different tribes. We spoke different languages, but we were quite friendly. He was a mathematician. I was a linguist. He hadn't the slightest interest in the German language, and I was out of my depth with mathematics. I have a mental image of him, staring into the middle distance and twiddling his pencil, making counts on reams of paper. And I used to wonder whether he was getting anything done. My goodness, he was. He was breaking Tunny. Once he had done that, we knew how the system worked. Tut broke Tunny in spring 42. The Tunny system encrypted not once, not twice, but 3 times. I would think it is almost unique that anybody has broken something with 3 levels of encryption.
Do you think it's too late to adequately honour Bill Tut for what he achieved, given that he seems to be the least well recognised of your colleagues?
Any honour is an honour. If it comes late, that's bad, that's too bad. but it is our defect that we haven't done it already.
How do you feel personally about the honour you've received now that the dust settled a little?
Well, an honour is an honour, and the opportunity to meet Her Majesty again is a great bonus. The first time I met her and talked with her, she was absolutely charming, wonderful person, and I'd love to meet her again.
There was quite some fuss when it was announced over Christmas. There was some quite strongly felt public reaction that it wasn't
quite
enough.
Naturally.
How did that feel?
I was delighted, because I felt strongly myself. This is wrong. I feel I represent not just myself. I don't mind what honour I get. I don't even mind if I don't get one. I lived without one for 92 years. I can manage a bit more, hopefully. But I feel I represent the testatory, and they did a fantastic job. And an MBE is not a fantastic decoration.
If you've made some progress of getting people to get behind the importance of what was achieved and appreciate it a bit better.
In fairness, I don't think they know the full story. But then they didn't try to find out either.
You've been chipping away more and more into the public consciousness and awareness of what was achieved and the complexity of it. Alan Turing's become quite a famous name in recent years, especially this last year, his centenary year. Do you perhaps welcome some of the attention that his life and work has received as a portal for people to find out more about the rest of it?
I think it will happen slowly. I'm doing my best to make it happen fast. Todd's birthday is 5 years from now. Have we got to wait till then? I would say to the authorities, it's a scandal, you've done nothing. Get on with it. Give him a posthumous knighthood. And if you can't do that, it's your job to think of something else you can do. The responsibility is yours. Get on with it.
There's no overnight fix, is there, unfortunately, to make people realise the importance. There's no one documentary or website or museum exhibit that can hammer it into the public consciousness.
Well, bear in mind the film did. For those people who saw the film, and I've estimated there were about 4 million.
The BBC programme, The Lost Heroes of Bletchley Park, that you took part in.
Small correction. It wasn't a BBC programme. It was a BBC Wales programme.
I think it's the complexity of it. So sometimes scientific information is boiled down to such a degree in the media and made so easy. I wonder if that's part of the challenge you've faced in recent years.
I understand what you mean, but I don't present it that way. For me, the big question is, did it make any difference? And it made a huge difference. And this is what people should take note of first. And that usually puts a different aspect on the whole thing. What can we do about it? We have these three men, whom I call the three heroes of Bletchley Park. Turing, Tutt, and Tommy Flowers. Turing stopped not just Britain but Europe being plunged into 50 years of a Nazi dark age. Tutt helped greatly to shorten the war. Tommy Flowers has laid the foundation of everything that's happened on the computer world internationally. These were great men, and they have not been treated like great men. They did great things, achieved great things. I would like to suggest a joint statue on that fourth plinth in Trafalgar Square. That's if David Beckham doesn't mind.
They were great men, but you now champion their cause and you are their greatest advocate.
Absolutely.
And you must not underestimate the value of how much you've done to bring them to public attention.
Well,
and you may not be where you want to be with it, but you've come
a
very long way.
It's something. There's a lot more we need to do. We just keep plugging away.
We will. We will. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for giving the time, both of you.
It's an honour, Jerry. Thank you for sharing. February the 28th was an incredible day. I went to Buckingham Palace. I was very kindly invited by Captain Jerry Roberts and his wife May on what turned out to be not only the day he met the Queen for the second time and received his MBE, but also their 21st wedding anniversary.
That must have been a real honour.
It was. It was breathtaking. Each recipient gets to take three guests along to the investiture ceremony, and it's all pomp and ceremony to the absolute max. You are told where to sit, where to stand, exactly how to behave. No phones on, no cameras inside the palace. There was a live orchestra in the balcony above in the ballroom, and we were on benches all around three sides of the room, and at the front it was all set up for Her Majesty. And she spoke individually to each recipient, and I mean, there were more than 100. And when Jerry's moment came, he had been in a wheelchair for most of the day, because let's not forget he's 92. But of course, he wanted to stand to meet Her Majesty, and he wasn't alone in that. There were a couple of other people of quite an advanced age receiving honours who did the same, and it was quite moving. So nobody else hears the conversation that each person has with Her Majesty, and they will give you varying accounts of how much they can remember, because it's such a big moment in everyone's life to whom that happens, that the adrenaline must be incredible.
You got a bit of an insight from Jerry on what the Queen actually did say to him.
Over lunch in Chinatown, yes we did. So, tell me, what did the Queen say to you, Jerry?
She said, "I remember you. We met at Bletchley Park." And I said, "Yes, that was a red letter day for us. You were so charming and interested. I talked about the tunny machine, because we were standing over a tunny machine. And she asked 4 or 5 questions, and always with that beautiful, warm and friendly smile. We must have talked for 6 or 7 minutes.
You were there a little while. I saw her flash that smile at a couple that were sat next to us on the way out that had been honoured together just shortly before you. And the warmth, you don't see that when you see her at official engagements and from that distance on TV. Yeah, she really takes an interest, doesn't she?
She certainly did.
How do you feel now about today?
I felt that I was standing in representing the other people in the test room who worked with me, especially the cryptographers. And I felt that, welcome as it was, the honour given to us was too low, far too low. I don't suggest a knighthood, but certainly an OB would have been more appropriate.
Did you think about your colleagues when you, in that moment, when you actually walked up to meet the Queen?
No. It's so personal.
Yeah.
You and her.
She just eclipses all other thoughts, doesn't she? You must only be able to focus on the fact that you're looking right at Her Majesty and she's focused on you.
If she was an ordinary person, it wouldn't make much difference. But she's not an ordinary person. And someone very special. And most of the people in the country don't know and don't realise that. I tell everybody about it because I've always been a royalist. The people who would rather not have a monarchy are usually rather disagreeable people and have no other alternative belief to offer.
What do you think you remember most about today?
Just the 2 or 3 with Her Majesty.
Do you get many chances
to
see
her? The rest of it is all rather long-winded. It took rather a long time.
There's a lot of people to get through.
Yes.
Thank you again for allowing me to be here. It's a great honour.
You're extremely welcome.
We'll be right back.